WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Monday, April 24th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Here are the stories we're following today. Did you think the radical left's insane plan for race reparations was dead? Well, think again. A number of U.S. cities controlled by the leftist race-baiting cabal are planning to pass huge appropriations for payments to every black resident and then make the rest of us foot the bill. Leading the pack, of course, is San Francisco. The city's African-American Reparations Advisory Committee has presented a plan to a receptive board of supervisors. The plan would guarantee black residents annual incomes of $97,000 for 250 years, as well as provide homes to black residents for $1 apiece. Here's some of the reasoning behind this.
We've heard a lot of critics, and even some of you may be questioning, why would we be seeking reparations for black San Franciscans? Many folks often say that California and San Francisco specifically did not enslave black people. And so there's lots of history that obviously needs to be researched, and I'm putting that responsibility on all of you to do that.
The plan is estimated to cost every non-black household in San Francisco at least $600,000. This is a city that has lost more than 6% of its population since 2020. It's a city that's already running a deficit of $290 million. But don't worry, there's an easy fix. Go to the federal government hat in hand and get the American taxpayers to pay for it all. After all, San Francisco already receives 10% of its budgetary money from state and federal aid. And if San Francisco's plan fails for being too extreme, the rest of California will step up on its own with its own $360,000 per black resident reparations plan. This too will eventually be paid for by the American taxpayers. And it only gets better, folks. Cities like Los Angeles, St. Louis, and Boston are also planning to pursue reparations. So in the end, while North Dakota farmers and Texas ranchers may want nothing to do with race reparations, they may be forced to pay for them anyway through the inevitable magic of federal grants and bailouts. And the amazingly scandalous Biden family continues to be afflicted by new charges of corruption. An anonymous IRS whistleblower contacted Congress and is willing to testify about how the Biden administration Department of Justice is intentionally mishandling the Hunter Biden investigation. Attorney Mark Little has written a letter officially requesting whistleblower protection for his client, an IRS official involved with the Hunter Biden investigation. And in a closely related story, an ex-CIA official is claiming that the Biden campaign was behind the letter that dismissed the Hunter Biden laptop and emails as a Russian disinformation ploy. The letter was signed by dozens of intelligence experts. Former CIA Deputy Director Michael Morell, who was among the 51 signers of the letter, told the House Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government that at first he didn't intend to write the letter. But Anthony Blinken, who at the time was an advisor to the Biden campaign, persuaded him to write and release the letter. According to the transcript of an interview with the subcommittee, Morell admitted that there were two intents in writing the letter and getting the 50 additional signatures. Quote, "One intent was to share our concern with the American people that the Russians were playing on this issue. And two, it was to help Vice President Biden," unquote. When Congressman Jim Jordan, the head of the subcommittee, asked why he wanted to help Biden, Morell said it was because he wanted Biden to win the election. Here's how Biden used the letter during his debate with Trump.
"There are 50 former national intelligence folks who said that what this he's accusing me of is a Russian plan."
I'm joined by my colleague at the New American Magazine, executive senior editor Steve Bonta. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm well. Quite a lot happening. The news cycle apparently never stops. But you know, one thing I've noticed with all this news coming out about this corrupt Biden family, I've yet to see any headlines in mainstream media that any of the sort of gnashing of teeth and shrieking that we saw with Trump, that we're discovering all this corruption with Biden. But The media doesn't seem to be too concerned about that.
No. The media coverage of what I like to call the Bidino crime family is sparse at best. I think CBS did a story on the latest allegations, and when they do cover it, Typically it's to show why the accusations against Biden are ill-founded.
Oh,
they're hypercritical of anyone who accuses their white-haired hero of any type of impropriety. But of course, with Trump, every last rumor that came out was
every
amplified.
Phone call, amplified. Every statement, every tweet.
Yeah.
There's a new story. I got the New York Times from this morning and the Washington Post. I tried to find out what they wrote about Biden. So here's the one from the Washington Post. Democrats reluctant about Biden 2024, but they see no other choice. And then, of course, here is from the New York Times, how Democrats learn to cast aside reservations and embrace Biden 2024.
Yes, that sounds a little bit like that Stanley Kubrick film, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, or whatever it was. But
it's crazy. They don't. What is your take on this? We keep learning more. It seems are the whistleblowers, are folks getting a little braver? It's such a good thing to have this, the House in the control, I guess, of Republicans in some sense, because we're seeing so much come out.
We are. I mean, it's surprised me that any of the Morrell apparently was the guy. You know, the story that he came out with, just to be perfectly clear, was that he, and he's one of the highest ranking people, signatories of this paper, although, you know, the infamous Brennan was there. I think Leon Panetta was one of the nine people who refused to be named in the original release of the letter, but he signed it as well. And various other people who are, and some that I'd never heard of, you know, who are lower level functionaries, but in any event, he claims, or he claimed to Jordan's subcommittee, that initially he didn't want to write the letter. Then what happened was Anthony Blinken, who was an advisor to the
Biden campaign,
and of course now as Secretary of State, came to him, sat him down, basically put him through the ringer. He didn't couch it quite that way, but you could tell that's what he was saying. And he said, I came out of the meeting convinced of the need to write this letter. And then he went on and, you know, and presumably what transpired between the two was, hey, do you want Trump to win again? Do you? Because if you don't, you'll do this. And that's what it amounted to. And, of course, they're both all of them are completely convinced of the righteousness of their cause. They don't see anything wrong with it. And I'm shocked that they were able to get any admissions against interest out of this guy. It was a non-televised session. So all we have is the transcript of it. But still quite remarkable that he would admit even that.
Was he sure? And I don't know if we made that clear, that he was convinced at least that this was a Russian ploy? Because there's a difference. If he does this, and as an intelligence officer, he doesn't believe that was the case, but just wanted to do to swing the favor in Biden, versus the fact that they really did believe that as intelligence officers. Do we know if he actually...
We don't. That's a good question. It's not clear from what I've been able to glean. Not sure that he made that clear, but one suspects, without knowing for sure, but one suspects that they probably all thought, it may be, but regardless of whether it is or not, the overarching priority is to get rid of Trump. And so who really cares if it's genuine?
So much for them being apolitical.
My guess would be that was probably, I doubt very much that they believed down to their wicked core with absolute conviction that this had to be a Russian disinformation ploy. I mean, they had to have known, for one thing, this was on a laptop that, you know, and things that were not even revealed until after the election was safely in the bag, or so they thought, that this laptop, in fact, was not something that had been conjured out of thin air, but instead had been left at a repair shop and
that's been the story.
Inexplicably abandoned. And, of course, has since been completely verified that it was, in fact, Hunter's laptop. The stuff is all genuine. It wasn't Russian disinformation.
Well, I don't think it's so inexplicable, because based on what we've learned about Hunter Biden's drug problems and things like that, is it real? I mean, the guy probably forgot about it. You know, he was smoking crack or whatnot. So, when you're smoking crack, you tend to forget about things, Steve.
Well, the disquieting possibility is that maybe he has many such laptops or many such places where video records of his many and multifarious peccadilloes are recorded, and he simply happened to forget about one of them.
Again, when you're smoking crack, maybe you forget that you have that many laptops flowing around. It's not to make fun of and really downgrade people who have drug problems, but this is obviously, it might go into his judgment. Speaking of judgment, this insane reparations thing, it's moving through, man. It looks like, what are the chances that this advisory board will get what they wanted out of the, I guess it's the city council or whoever it is that's going to end up making these decisions in San Francisco?
Well, considering it's San Francisco, I'd say the chances are pretty good.
Gosh.
I mean, San Francisco for a very long time has been the nexus of all that is irrational, insane, countercultural, and corrosive of the body politic in the United States. And so this is the latest thing. Of course, I mean, I sort of included that. I prepared the story and the clip of the lady giving the rationale or the reasoning for it, you know, was kind of amusing because she said, well, you know, some of you are saying, well, California never even had slaves and you know, they were prohibited. We never had slavery in the territory of state of California, which is true. So you're asking yourselves, why would we demand reparations? Well, you're just going to have to do research on that.
Right, right.
In other words, I'm not going to give you a reason because there really isn't a rational reason.
No. Yeah. Steve, I mean, I've read here about the Imago Pruitt Project, and I've read a little bit about the Great Society that was planned and things like that. I have yet to read anywhere in history that giving people money for free works. Have you?
Well, yeah, no. I mean, this is another attempt by the left to redistribute wealth, to shake down America's productive classes. And by the way, there are plenty of so-called people of color who are among their number who will also be paying.
Who will also be paying, right? Those out of those cities, right?
Yes, and I mean, I'm just the whole concept of reparations. If they were enacted, amount to a type of ex post facto law, which means criminalizing something after the fact. It is an unhappy fact that at one time in the history of a certain portion of the United States, slavery was legal.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fact.
Right.
And so to punish people today for the legality of this atrocious practice, you know, 150, 200, 300 years ago, whatever. When none of us were alive. And indeed, you know, I mean, you don't have any slave owners in your ancestry, okay?
Right.
I think the general consensus family lore is there probably are some because some of my ancestors came from Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know for sure. But, you know...
Am I going to be excused because my family came here?
No, of course not. Because you're white. You know, this whole thing is profoundly racist, and the fact that it isn't just limited to reparations in the here and now, but this outlandish proposal goes on for the next 200 years, I think.
250 years, we reported.
Absolutely, they're going to guarantee income for the next 200 years, and all this kind of thing is absolutely insane. But handouts of money. Yeah, well, as you said, they never achieve. Well, I want to say this: they do in fact achieve their desired aim, which is never what the stated aim is. The stated aim is to, you know, to level the scales of justice, to right some wrong, right? Whether you're shelling out money to people who are chronically unemployed or whatever, but the real aim is to destabilize and radically rework the entire
Absolutely.
Way that society works. And in that sense, these things do achieve their purpose. They certainly do.
I mean, I can't see how that wouldn't be achieved with this. This is clearly, that's what it would accomplish. And they don't, like the lady said, and like you pointed out, you know, for those of you who are worried, why would we do this? Her answer is like, well, we don't have, like you said.
I'm not going to tell you.
We
you
don't
just
really
have
know.
To accept
Go ahead
it.
And
sure.
search it out on your own. Like, obviously you don't have an answer. You know, it's just pandering. And it's unfortunate that we've moved this far along with it. Hopefully you're wrong and it doesn't go anywhere.
I hope to be wrong.
Thanks, Steve. Stay tuned, folks, because we'll be right back to discuss the rest of our stories.
If Americans want to remain a free and sovereign nation, more people need to understand the principles and values that built this great nation. At the John Birch Society, we have the organization, the plan, and the resources to do just that. Our founder, Robert Welch, said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org to learn more, including how you can get involved to work locally and impact nationally. Join the John Birch Society today.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
The truth is hard to find, but the New American has it. Check it out at thenewamerican.com.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son Noah did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board, and I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack, and because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
Welcome back. Let's look at our other stories. So there will be no federal ban on the abortion drug mifepristone, at least for the time being. The Supreme Court issued an order Friday that allows the abortion pill to remain available by mail order. The ruling is the latest in a controversial legal battle over the medication. Justice Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito issued a public dissent. Eric Baptist is senior counsel of the Alliance for Defending Freedom, which is representing plaintiffs in the case. And he told Andrew Wilco why this case is so important, not only to save babies' lives, but also the lives and health of their mothers.
It's both reckless and unlawful. It's reckless because, as you note, sending these drugs by mail, and this is a two-drug regimen. The first drug kills the baby, and the second drug induces labor and delivery. And when they're inducing labor and delivery, that's just an inherently dangerous thing to do in the first place and outside of the medical setting. Without a doctor examine a woman before she takes these drugs to determine even if she's pregnant, confirm her gestational age, or even identify a life-threatening ectopic pregnancy, which these drugs will not help and treat, but can mask the symptoms and create a life-threatening complication situation for that, is just so dangerous to do. And then to induce labor and delivery by yourself without any medical supervision or any support whatsoever, this is what has led to our nation's emergency rooms being filled with women on a regular basis.
Baptist also pointed out that women who misjudge their infant's gestational age, meaning they're further along in pregnancy than they thought, have been known to deliver a live baby at home after using this drug. Mifepristone has been controversial since the year 2000 when the FDA first approved it. Only 6 years later, a government reform subcommittee investigated an alarming number of deaths and severe adverse effects of the drug on otherwise healthy women. They noted that post-marketing safety monitoring was extremely poor. The drug now bears a black box warning because it can cause prolonged bleeding, infection, and sepsis. A black box warning is the strongest measure short of pulling a drug off the market. Planned Parenthood's research arm, the pro-abortion Guttmacher Institute, reports that more than half of U.S. abortions are medication-induced, and mifepristone is the most commonly used for chemical abortions. And how did you celebrate Earth Day this past Saturday? Well, President Biden decided to use the opportunity to push forth the green agenda.
Earth Day is tomorrow, a chance to reflect on the national wonders of our nation and our planet, but we have to do a great deal more than just reflect. We have to commit ourselves to action.
Well, what kind of action? It turns out that Biden used Earth Day Eve as the occasion to sign an executive order euphemistically titled Revitalizing Our Nation's Commitment to Environmental Justice for All. Let's look at what this executive order will do.
Under this order, environmental justice will become the responsibility of every single federal agency. I mean, every single federal agency. That means every federal agency must take into account environmental and health impacts on communities and the work to prevent those negative impacts. Environmental justice will be the mission of the entire government, woven directly into how we work with state, local, tribal, and territorial governments. This executive order creates a new Office of Environmental Justice and a new role for the Chief Environmental Justice Officer. They're going to coordinate. They will coordinate all our efforts across government to make sure we're delivering the greatest possible benefits to people's lives.
Biden also used the occasion to boast about this environmental record as president, including signing an executive order to re-enter the Paris Climate Agreement on the first day of his presidency. The agreement, which was never ratified by the U.S. Senate, is supposed to limit the amount of CO2 released into the atmosphere. Earlier this month, Biden's EPA proposed tougher tailpipe emission rules for automobiles, including carbon dioxide emissions. Though the proposed rules would not ban gasoline-powered vehicles, they would result in their reduction and the increase of electric cars on the road. And there's more to come. The New York Times reported that the EPA is poised to propose the first controls on greenhouse gases from power plants. The paper said, if the regulation is implemented, it will be the first time the federal government has limited carbon dioxide emissions from existing power plants, which generate 25% of U.S. greenhouse gases. Of course, none of this is surprising. Prior to becoming president, Biden made his position on reliable energy clear.
But kiddo, I want you to just take a look, okay? You don't have to agree, but I want you to look in my eyes. I guarantee you, we're going to end fossil fuel, and I am not going to cooperate with you, okay?
Well, Steve, I gotta admit, he seems to have at least delivered on this promise. He's really trying to live up to that, to kill fossil fuels.
Yeah, he is. Although I notice, and this may just be me, but I noticed that in this year's Earth Day speech, he's wearing those scary trademark dark glasses that he's taken to wearing pretty much almost everywhere. Whereas a couple years ago, he had no dark glasses on. He shook no glasses at all, in fact, and looked that lady in the eye and shook her hand. And that's one campaign promise he has consistently kept.
Yeah,
dark glasses or no. Yeah, so I'm just saying the dark glasses make him look more gangsta, and I'm sure that's the point.
You know,
I don't know if you noticed earlier in the previous segment, there was a picture of him with Hunter Biden, and they both had shades on.
Yeah.
So they're really kind of playing up this image.
The gangster look?
Absolutely.
There you go. Well, now, it seems to be truer than perhaps most people have known. But do you remember when Earth Day was about, like, not littering? And
No. It's always been about littering. In fact, this is a point that's been noted year after year, is that every year...
No, that's my point. It used to be about littering, right? Not throwing stuff in the rivers.
No. My point is that, yes, that was their professed aim.
Yeah, yeah.
But they would always have these big Earth Day get-togethers in Central Park and in, you know, down in Washington, D.C. And always there would be massive amounts of litter left by all the participants, all the people who professedly are opposed to littering and taking care of the Mother Earth. Somehow that conduct doesn't, or that belief doesn't carry through to their actual conduct. So this has been a recurring news story for us and
that
other people.
That is so reflective of the widespread BS that this campaign is, this green agenda. It's just such BS. And you're right. You know, you go to these places and they'll have some big gathering about the earth and whatnot. And they'll leave their just trash everywhere and whatnot.
And let's not forget all the private jets. You know, I mean, hypocrisy is just rank with hypocrisy. And I mean, if they were all willing to go out and live a subsistent, you know, existence in the wilderness like the people in that show that we like to talk about alone, then I would say, okay, well, I may not agree with them, but at least they have the sincerity of their convictions. But that doesn't seem to be the case, because I think a lot of them have not actually spent a lot of time in the outdoors. Full disclaimer, I've spent a lot of time camping, roughing it in places like Alaska and tropical rainforests. I know what it's like to get bitten by leeches and attacked by mosquitoes, because I happen to really like the outdoors for my own reasons, okay? But many of them haven't. You know, for them, at best, the outdoors is something to be experienced from the safety of maybe a safari vehicle or a tour bus or some well-manicured, you know, path on a national park where you're a safe distance from anything that can eat
you. Oh, the bears.
Right, absolutely. And so, you know, nature, there's a reason that all civilized cultures have sought to subdue nature to a degree. And that is, if you do not subdue nature, it will subdue you eventually. I mean, right here in Wisconsin, we have things like tornadoes and bitter cold winters that, absent modern technology, would kill most of us.
Yeah.
That's just a fact.
Absolutely, yeah.
And everywhere you go in the world, there's, you know, nature is a very raw thing. That's not to say the earth is not beautiful or that it's worth conserving. It most assuredly is. I mean, I deplore the extinction, particularly of charismatic megafauna, as they like to say, like the ivory-billed woodpecker and so forth. I think it's a shame. Yeah. They're not around anymore, and it's kind of cool that we've brought the whooping cranes back from the brink and all this type of thing. But, you know, the overwhelming majority of these people don't really understand nature, don't understand biology, don't understand the fact that, you know, diseases and so forth are also part of nature, natural disasters and everything else. What they seek is
power.
Yeah, and the form that it would take would be a sort of absolute ascendancy over everything, and it would be a world in which nature would be this nice, manicured, well-kept museum that only they would have access to. But yeah, the unwashed like you and I would be completely excluded.
Yeah, that stinks. And I think you're right. And I think it is interesting that I do get the same sense as you. It's like these are not people who go hiking, who go camping or whatnot. They live in luxury and maybe they have a nice place in the woods with big windows. And that's the extent of whatnot. So, yeah, they're total hypocrites. That's for sure. Thanks, Steve. We've run out of time. And that is it for our news segment today. For more truth behind the news, make sure to get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you could call our office at 800-727-8783 Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. That's 800-727-8783. And don't go anywhere, because after this, we're going to show an interview that centers around OSHA, and we'll finish the episode with another principal segment. Gary and Steve here will be talking about the pursuit of happiness. We'll see you on the other side.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Join us in restoring this great nation.
Next up, The New American's Gary Benoit interviews John Birch Society Human Resource Director Drew Dorrance about a feature he wrote for the print magazine on OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Let's watch.
In the alphabet soup of federal agencies, OSHA is not the most prominent. Other agencies, such as the Environmental Protection Agency or the IRS, get a lot more play in the media. Yet OSHA is extremely important, and OSHA is devastating to American business. Let's take a look. This is Beyond the Cover with your host, Gary Benoit, and today we have with us the Director of Human Resources for the John Birch Society, Drew Dorrance. Drew, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Drew, of course, we invited you onto the program because of a recent article that you wrote in the April 24 issue of the New American Magazine. The title of that article, "Dismantle OSHA to Protect American Business." And I don't believe you dealt directly in your career with OSHA bureaucrats, but you have dealt with their handiwork, haven't you? Because you've been buried with paperwork.
Yeah. Not just paperwork, but also regulation. You know, I once worked in a warehouse, and warehouses are very regulated by OSHA. So you're dealing with a bunch of different safety protocols that OSHA has set forth.
Right. Now, OSHA stands for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So
correct.
Presumably, if you go by the title, if you assume there's truth in advertising, that there's truth in the name, it has something to do with safety and it has something to do with health. So here's the question. Do you think OSHA really improves safety and really improves health for American workers through its regulations?
Well, you know, initially the idea is a good idea. However, the way that OSHA goes about it is not. A lot of the regulations that they come up is pretty arbitrary. Nothing is backed by any sort of studies or any sort of actual data. They just like, oh, well, that looks unsafe, so we're going to make it that you had to do it this way. One example of that is when OSHA was first introduced, in the construction industry, equipment was color-coded. Well, you may go from company to company, the color coding might be different, or you know, or manufacturer for manufacturer, but when someone is licensed to run that piece of equipment, they understand the coding for that particular piece of equipment. And what OSHA did is they came in and said, nope, you got to change everything. All the equipment needs to be the same across the board. And that really caused more safety concern across the construction industry, because you know, people that have been running the same pieces of equipment for many, many years under one coding system, color coding system, that it got completely changed on them, and they started not operating it the way they should be operating it because the color codes are different.
Right. Now, of course, when you say it's a good idea, what you mean is that it's a good idea to have safety, and it's a good idea to have health, and good health, and I think everybody would agree with that. But it doesn't necessarily mean, does it, that this should be a function of the federal government? You know, for example, we all believe in education, but that does not mean there should be a Department of Education. It does not mean that that is a federal responsibility. So where in the Constitution is the authority? Of course, I guess this is a rhetorical question because we know it's not there. But how does OSHA find in the Constitution the authority to do what it does?
Well, if you're talking about my opinion, there is no authority. Right. You know, they do claim Commerce Clause, which mm-hmm. is a stretch of the imagination. If you go back to the Federalist Papers, that's not what it means. You know, however, if we're a true free market, mm-hmm. you know, organizations that are unsafe in their practices and don't treat their employees well, they're going to get canceled.
Right.
Because no one's going to want to work for them. It's kind of the same concept of a workers' union. You know, they had good intentions in the beginning, but the whole purpose of our free market is, you know, we as consumers, both as employees and people who purchase stuff, we have the ability to choose who we're going to work for and mm-hmm. who we're going to purchase for. And if you look at it that way, the companies that do not protect their employees from unsafe activities are not going to be in business, because sure. they're not going to have any employees. And even now in this day and age, it's even more prominent because we have social media that can completely destroy a company from anyone working at it. Because who's going to want to work for somebody that, you know, continually puts somebody at risk? You know, you have your occupational risk, and then you have, unnecessary risks with your occupation. And, you know, people accept that, you know, as, you know, someone that works up on electrical poles, that there's an occupational risk to that. Now, the companies that don't want to mitigate risk are the companies that aren't going to be able to find employees to do the services that they need them to do. So needing a government agency to step in to tell, you know, employers that they need to do these things, you know, kind of levels the playing field, and, you know, forces some people out of the market. But does it truly create a free market?
I would think it would have the opposite effect. Right. Now, OSHA was created in 1970 by an act of Congress.
Right.
It was signed into law by Richard Nixon, who at the time was president. And it was really a monstrosity, was it not? Because like other federal agencies, other parts of what has been called the fourth branch of government, it embodies legislative, executive, and judicial powers. What James Madison in the Federalist Papers described as the very definition of tyranny.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, you see that in more than just OSHA. Mm-hmm. You know, you see that in the DOJ, the ATF, you know, most prominently, you know, the principle-based rule with the ATF. They just make up new regulations as they go and then enforce it. And that is not their job. OSHA is supposed to be enforcing rules that Congress has brought out. But they continually you know, change the fine structure, and they continually just make up arbitrary rules. You know, an example of that is, you know, the toilet seat.
Yes.
All right, a toilet seat in a workplace is supposed to be open front end, according to OSHA. But what does that have to do with anything? You know, why are we worried about toilet seats?
Or did it, did that regulation even make toilet seats more sanitary?
Absolutely not. It depends on the end user and who cleans it. I mean, that's what we're looking at. Open end toilet seat doesn't make it any safer than a closed end toilet seat, but according to OSHA, somehow it does.
Well, this might be a good time to go to the OSHA cowboy, and we're going to display that on the screen for our viewers to see. But there's the OSHA cowboy, Drew. I know you've seen that before, but do you think all that apparatus, and you can describe some of that if you like, but do you think that makes the cowboy safer?
Just like the toilet seat, no. you know, when you look at this, you see a little, you know, it goes overboard, but in reality, OSHA has gone overboard in a lot of different places.
Well, that's what makes this so funny. I mean, obviously, it's a cartoon, but what makes it funny is the fact that, you know, this is not totally unrealistic. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, OSHA does. Yeah. And you know what my favorite part of that is, Drew? Do you see that little box there behind the horse?
That
EPA, emission control system. That's my favorite.
Honestly, that's my favorite too. Because you see that.
Well, I think it does illustrate that OSHA is full of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and also too, this embodies the fact that you know, OSHA wanted farmers to put roll cages on their tractors, but then that just makes it heavier. Tractors are going through the mud. I'm pretty sure every farmer would agree with me. The tractors are heavy enough. Mm-hmm. You know, and they need to be able to get out of the mud, and that's, you know, the whole evolution of a tractor is to get out of the mud. You start adding weight to them, then they're going to get stuck.
You know what you just pointed out, Drew, really, I think underscores that the cartoonist who came up with that OSHA cartoon was onto something.
He definitely was. Mm-hmm. You know, and in that picture too, you see see the net underneath, and one of the things that OSHA did is that you had to have a net over combustible engines and moving parts.
Yes.
And, you know, in the poultry industry, they would get, you know, the nets would get a bunch of feathers in them and actually shut down production. And then somebody would have to unsafely go and pull it all out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Now, as we discussed earlier, OSHA was created in 1970. And in the late 1970s, I'm not sure I can recall the exact year, but maybe 1978 or so, but there was a famous Supreme Court case that clipped the wings of OSHA to some extent, and it involved a businessman actually who was a member of the John Birch Society. His name was Bill Barlow, and he had a business having to do with electrical and also plumbing installations. And the OSHA inspector came to his business, which was located in Idaho, and Mr. Barlow was not about to allow that inspector to inspect non-public areas of his business. And it resulted in a law case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court found in Barlow's favor. Barlow's argument, of course, was that under the Constitution, under the Fourth Amendment, that the federal government is prohibited to engage in warrantless searches and procedures. And I'd just like to read that amendment from the Constitution. Again, it's amendment number four. But it says, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So I'm going to say thank God for great Americans like Bill Barlow, who refused to go along with OSHA's unconstitutional usurpations. But my question for you, Drew, is what happened after that. OSHA is still around, but I wonder if there are businessmen, many businessmen today, who know that they can say no, that they can say no to OSHA in terms of a search in non-public areas unless OSHA gets a warrant.
Well, a lot of people are getting bullied into it. I can tell you, as a human resources professional, going through my bachelor's and my master's degree in human resources, nobody ever told me that you can say no to OSHA.
Right.
You know, because of, you know, educational institutions having a leftist lean, they never tell you that. They never tell you that you can deny OSHA from coming in for an inspection. They don't tell you that. So, and I would assume, you know, most business schools don't tell you this as well. So, you know, you're getting into a situation where, you know, people don't know that they have the right to say no. And when they do say no, OSHA tries to bully their way in. And, you know, you find there's actually a court case, and I believe it was 2017, U.S. versus Marjack Poultry. And what they did is the OSHA agents tried to bully their way in because there was a workplace injury that the workplace did properly report to OSHA when it did happen, mm-hmm. and OSHA wanted to inspect. They were denied. But they tried to bully their way in, and it made it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, again, sided with Freedom,
right,
and said, no, you cannot bully your way into a workplace just to inspect on a whim. You know, because part of reporting an injury in a workplace is also doing an assessment of what happened. So, you know, when you have a safety officer on site and they're doing that and they figure out the cause of the accident, there's no need for investigation from the, from an outside agency. Again, we're going back to our free market where if an employer doesn't care about their employees, they're not going to have the workers. So, of course, it is an employer's best interest to find out what happened and how to prevent future injuries so that they can maintain their business. And OSHA bullying their way into these businesses to do an inspection is, you know, completely against the Constitution.
Absolutely. Now, one final question is, what can the businessman do about this, and what can the American people in general do about it?
Well, for the short term, people can deny OSHA access mm-hmm. to their business. The biggest thing is writing your congressman.
Right.
Currently, there is an act called the NOSHA Act that is in committee in Congress. It was introduced last session, and I'm pretty sure it'll be introduced again if it's not taken care of. But it nullifies OSHA. It takes OSHA right out of the equation, and we reduce the number of government agencies and reduce our deficit and reduce harassing of businesses so that they are not targeted and OSHA isn't weaponized against our businesses like we have seen other agencies weaponized against political opponents and other activist organizations.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Drew. And before we sign off, we do want to encourage all of our viewers to see your great article in the New American Opinion magazine. Once again, that is the April 24 issue. So please go to that issue and see Drew's article. And the title of the article is Dismantle OSHA to Protect American Business. Thank you, Drew.
Thank you.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Ditch the fake news and always get the truth. Go to thenewamerican.com.
If Americans want to remain a free and sovereign nation, more people need to understand the principles and values that built this great nation. At the John Birch Society, we have the organization, the plan, and the resources to do just that.
Our founder, Robert Welch, said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org to learn more, including how you can get involved to work locally and impact nationally. Join the John Birch Society today.
They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes.
Here's the news, Dad.
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days.
Ditch the fake news and always get the truth. Go to thenewamerican.com.
And to complete today's show is another installment of Principles. And this time, Gary Benoit interviews Steve Bonta and they discuss the pursuit of happiness.
This is Gary Benoit, editor-in-chief of The New American Magazine. And today we have with us the executive senior editor, Steve Bonta. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Gary. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you. Now, today we want to talk about another principle in our ongoing series of looking at principles. And today's principle deals with a phrase that I'm sure everybody has heard of, but probably not a whole lot of people have put a lot of thought into. And that is the pursuit of happiness, which, of course, is found in the Declaration of Independence. It's one of the unalienable rights that's actually cited in the Declaration. So what do we mean, Steve, by the pursuit of happiness?
Well, again, what don't we mean by the pursuit of happiness? The pursuit of happiness and the pursuit of pleasure are not necessarily the same thing. And it does seem to me that a lot of people kind of confound those two ideas.
Okay, so we do not mean the pursuit of pleasure necessarily.
I mean, pleasure, there are good pleasures. Not all pleasure is illicit, of course.
Right.
And so certainly, you know, going out and having an ice cream cone and going to see a movie and all this sort of thing, you know, these are pleasurable experiences that I think also contribute to our happiness and well-being. But the pursuit of happiness. I mean, again, happiness, as we talked about in previous episodes, we've talked about these unalienable rights. It can't be properly understood except in an individual context and in a context of freedom of choice, okay? Because happiness is a choice that we make.
In other words, somebody could choose to be unhappy or depressed.
Well, yes, I mean, people choose to be unhappy and so forth, but it's a choice that we make. And of course, the pursuit of happiness, the word pursuit means we may or may not attain it, or we may attain it in varying degrees. And so that implies that we're going to make mistakes. And one of the errors that people, I think, fall into is that making a mistake is absolutely just the worst thing you can possibly do.
Mm-hmm.
When in point of fact, most of us learn only by making mistakes. So most people who are very wealthy have only gotten there by failing numerous times, going bankrupt or whatever, and picking themselves up and so forth. So the lives of most, if not all, successful men and women are typical litanies of mistakes and failure and so forth, in pursuit of some goal or another, whether it's a wealth or some other type of, however they gauge success. The thing about happiness is this. It's not necessary. There are certain commonalities to happiness. So it's impossible to be happy in any meaningful way if we're leading vicious and immoral lives. So that's where, illicit pleasure definitely contradicts the idea of happiness.
Yes.
So, the Lothario, the whoremonger, the drug addict, other people, who think that they're doing things that make them happy when, in fact, all it does is give them a temporary jolt of pleasure, they're, in fact, making themselves miserable.
So obviously, if they don't change their ways by the end of their lives, then they lose everything in eternity.
Well, yes, sure. So that's important to understand. But that said, beyond the obvious fact that a lot of individual misconduct is just plain wrong, what makes one person happy in a legitimate sense is not necessarily going to make another person happy, because people have differing talents and differing likes and dislikes.
Sure.
So while one person may achieve happiness and fulfillment in, let's say, pursuing a career in music because that's what they love, okay? Mm-hmm. Another person who is tone deaf or just doesn't see the point is going to want to do something totally different, okay? And I mean, in some sense, the pursuit of happiness is, it's one of the most fundamental of all rights, because if we have the right to pursue happiness individually, several things are going to happen. Number one, most of us probably are going to, you know, progress and improve in this life. Not everybody will, of course. Some people make abominable choices in their lives and create misery for themselves and others, and that's an unfortunate consequence. But that's one thing. Another thing is we're going to end up being profoundly unequal. Some of us will be richer than others. Some of us will have more degrees than others. Some of us will have much more natural talent or will develop more talent in one area than others. Some of us will be stronger and more athletic than others, and on and on and on. But this is a good thing, okay? The people on the other side who are always going on about diversity, they got it half right. I mean, diversity is a positive thing to the extent that it means different people pursuing
different interests,
whatever happiness right. and interests and talents that God has ordained to them, and we know that these are very different from person to person. On the whole, contributes to the good of society. So people like you and I aren't necessarily very good at building a bridge or a highway, or flying an airplane, or designing a computer, or doing that. But there are people out there who do all of those good things who might not necessarily be able to do what we're doing right now.
Right, you know? But might enjoy what they're doing.
Right, might enjoy
what they're doing. Might enjoy building a bridge, for
right,
example.
And greatly enrich society in the process.
Right.
So thank goodness not
right.
everybody is like us, right.
right?
Otherwise, the bridges would never
right.
get built, and we wouldn't have any technology. You know, you need to have the engineers and the builders and everybody. And it's very clear that people are capable of enjoying happiness and fulfillment and satisfaction in a very, very, very broad and diverse array of endeavors. And that's really what the pursuit of happiness means. And, you know, I guess on a larger scale, this is the beauty of human beings. There's a tendency in the world today to say, well, we have too many people. We're overpopulated. And that's a negative view of things. The positive view is each new human soul is going to contribute, hopefully, his or her talents to the betterment and progress of society. Okay? And the more people we have, the more progress we can make, quite frankly. I mean, it takes an incredible amount of individual talent working together in these mm-hmm. incredibly complex production chains to create something like this laptop or this microphone or something even more complex like a jet airplane. Okay? If we didn't have huge numbers, millions of people, literally, involved in these sorts of enterprises, we couldn't have this stuff because individually, you know, I mean, we're all good at something, but none of us is good at everything.
Right.
Right? And the famous, you know, the luminous essay by Leonard Reed many years ago, I Pencil, points out so eloquently how even a simple item like a pencil cannot possibly be designed and built by a single person. You need lots of different people
sure.
with different talents, with different living in different situations, all of whom in their respective spheres are pursuing their individual happiness. They're doing the work that they think is best for them and their families and so forth and so on. And in this almost
sure.
magical way, those efforts come together and interlock, and we end up with not just pencils, but jet airplanes
right.
and satellites
course,
and things like that.
It benefits not just the individual person, but yeah. society as a whole. And it may be done for the purpose of the individual person. You know, a farmer, for example, may farm in order to feed his family,
mm-hmm.
In order to earn money that he can use to pursue his own happiness, which may include farming, but may include other things as well. But one thing I'd like to point to, though, would be the American dream.
Mm.
I think that's a good example of the pursuit of happiness because not everyone is involved making a pencil, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But the American dream is something that I think Americans, you know, on a societal level, aspire to. What does the American dream mean to you?
Well, I mean, it's one of those terms that means many things to many different people, just mm-hmm. like the pursuit of happiness does.
Mm-hmm.
It means, in effect, having the freedom to pursue those goals that make your life meaningful, that make mm-hmm. you feel fulfilled. I mean, and this is exceedingly important. I mean, there's the famous parable of the talents in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
where people are given different, and the talent was originally a unit of weight and of money, of course. But the idea is that if God gives us talents, we have a certain moral obligation to develop them, both for ourselves and for the betterment of people around us, regardless of what those talents happen to be. Okay, and in case anyone's curious, it is quite routine historically speaking, for governments to seek to take away the individual right of the pursuit of happiness.
Right.
Okay.
And going back to the American dream, I think we can see examples of that there, because when I think of the American dream and what that means to most people, I think it's the ability to own a house, for example, where you actually own something. So you can buy some property, you can own a house, you can have a car in the driveway, which gives you mobility, perhaps have two cars in the driveway. You can get married and have children and live your life the way you want to without outside government interference. And, of course, all that is being threatened today by big government, which is becoming bigger and bigger.
Sure. And again, historically speaking, most regimes, most empires and states in mm-hmm. times past, and even not below the level of the state, most societies have tended to impose these rigid caste systems and rigid sets of rules that dictate, you know, again, whom you can marry, where you can live,
right.
what kind of work you can do, the creation of guilds, and, you know, the feudalism in medieval Europe was kind of about that, too. You know, you were born in a certain station in life, and that was it. Okay, and to a right. limited sense, yes, you could pursue happiness within these very, very narrowly defined parameters, but certainly nothing like what we understand in the American system.
Sure. And I think that's where that expression, the American dream, comes from. And of course, also the pursuit of happiness and the Declaration of Independence, because in America, the government was limited. We did not have a caste system. And people were able to pull themselves up by the bootstraps and be able to pursue their dreams.
Right. I mean, there's a famous book by called The Road to Serfdom, and it characterizes socialism as being mm-hmm. the road to what is a serf? Well, a serf is a person by definition who has no right to pursue happiness.
Right.
He is a person whose existence is very narrowly circumscribed by the will of his laird, his lord, the person, his liege, right? Mm-hmm. That he owes absolute fealty and allegiance to, and he has no choice. He is going to be a poor tiller of dirt his entire life. He is going to surrender much of his income to his liege. He is never going to be able to own property on his own. And, you know, his choices are extremely limited. So the idea of life being the purpose of life being the pursuit of happiness is foreign to those who have lived their lives in serfdom. And even today, you know, there are still
sure.
places in the world where that's the case.
Well,
thank goodness.
And unfortunately, we're going down that road to serfdom today, but we can mm-hmm. certainly reverse course.
Yep.
So thank you very much, Steve. And we'll talk to you again next week about another principle.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you for joining us today. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. We will see you tomorrow.